Okay, well, we're here, you're there, everybody's somewhere, and it's always hard to tell which one is which. But we're going to give it the best shot we can to figure this all out. Fish and Frank, Robert in the chair across from me. We've got your top five best bets of the week, plus we got a little bit on shark fishing, sharks moving in. Okay, I just had to do it. I couldn't help it. Two notes, be very scary. If you want to be really scary, only use two notes.
They did a very successful job of it.
Yeah. You know, hit an F and an F sharp and you've got it made. All right, lots of stuff. I would say probably to get right into the top five. Are you doing all right, Robert?
I'm not doing too bad. How about you, Frank?
Fuzzy. Actually been taking some time off. My brain doesn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, that's because you went, what, like 3 months without one actual day off?
I think I had two days off since November. So,
yeah.
You know, I get a little fuzzy. Lot less grouchy than I was. That's better.
Well, your feet are probably feeling a little better, too.
Yeah, I'm down to one sore spot. So
only one. Nice. Yeah, it's the whole left foot, yeah. Right?
All right. So my sore feet aside, my age and in, you know, experience notwithstanding, Snook is the big story of the week.
Yeah, Snook has been really incredible. I mean, the warmer water, and then we had this little cold front come through. It's just getting the fish super excited, and they're getting into their little pre-spawn groups out there, especially as you get like down south towards Bull Bay, Turtle Bay, up and down the intercoastal through Lemon Bay. You know, it's been pretty good.
You know, I can't find my iPhone because I was going to look up on fishandfranks.com and see what the water flow on the Peace River was, because you go to the fishandfranks.com weather and tides and click the Peace River button, you see the water flow. It was down less than 2 feet, which means there was like 100 cubic feet a second coming at us, not enough to really change anything.
Right.
So in my opinion, I think a lot of these snook are not going to go to the intercoastal unless we get some serious rain here very quickly. You know, fish don't actually stick their head up out of the water and go, oh, look, there's the big yellow house and the old pine tree. And so I'm not out to the Gulf yet. They're in the water, and all they see is what's in the water.
Right.
You know, they're seeing 15 feet ahead of them. And they swim along, and they can tell when they've got salt and when they don't have salt.
Right.
Now, I don't think a fish would know the difference between the mouth of a canal and a pass in the Gulf.
Yeah, probably not.
I mean, right now, the water's just as salty in Port Charlotte in the canals as it is in the Gulf of Mexico.
I'd say it's real close. Absolutely. I'd
be pretty much six and one half dozen the other. So if you're a fish and you're swimming along underwater, you're waiting to get to clear, salty water and go, okay, instinct has told you over a million gazillion years, whatever it's been, over the last billion years, that you go out and when you hit the saltwater passes, that's where you spawn.
Right.
So how would they know the difference between the mouth of a canal right now or, say, the mouth of some of the creeks? But I would say, you know, some of those canal mouths are pretty large.
Yeah.
So I don't think they could tell the difference. So I think a lot of these fish are not going to leave Port Charlotte, Punta Gorda, Cape Coral, Lemon Bay. I think they're just going to go right to the mouth of the canal and think they're sitting in a pass.
Yeah, they could, absolutely. And I don't even know if they actually spawn in the pass itself. Because, I mean, those fish actually go out. I mean, guys have caught them out there in 50 feet of water on some of those nearshore reefs. So I don't know if they necessarily have to be right in the pass to spawn, as long as they've got good current and water flow. So the mouth of a canal is going to be the same as anything out there or in one of the passes.
Well, I think they spawn around the passes figuring on catching that incoming tide to wash the eggs in, because the eggs are going to hatch and the fry swim up into the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're, you know, a snook and you're going to make babies, you get someplace, the mouth of a canal, a pass, you spawn, and in the interim between spawns, you're looking for possible mates, because fish doesn't do it just once. It goes with, you know, they release some eggs and they find a different male or something to get together with. And pretty trashy fish, snooker. You know, one male to the next male to the next male. And the spawn can last do several times over the course of the month or so.
Right.
So they're getting together. The eggs go out. The males fertilize the eggs. And that's why you, when you're out on the beach right now and you're out there walking around, knee-deep water. And really that's all you're looking for is knee-deep water to look for snook. And you see a big snook and you see a whole bunch of little ones around it. And that's usually a bigger female with a whole entourage of little males coming up all vying for attention, waiting for her to do her eggs so that they can all get in there on it.
Right. Yeah, because they don't build a nest the way a lot of your freshwater fish do. They actually free swim and go up and lay their eggs as they're going up into the water column. And then the males swim through and release their milk or sperm into that cloud of eggs, and then the eggs float away into the current. And then they usually try to time it with a specific time of the tide, usually on the stronger incoming tide, which usually happens around the new moon and the full moon.
So then the eggs are part of the plankton, basically, and they get washed into the harbor on the tides, and then the eggs hatch, and they all swim for backcountry stuff, the canals around the mangroves, because they've got to hide from predators. They got seagulls after them. They've got fish feeding on plankton when they're eggs. They're all kinds of critters trying to eat them when they're eggs and then when they're fry. And then as they start getting bigger, then you have all the wading birds attacking them and seagulls and terns and pelicans. And
Life, something's after them, and it's just changes of the size of the predator that's after them.
Right. So it's not like a Disney movie where, oh, the babies are here and everybody just take care of the babies. This is, okay, you're on your own, sucker, you know.
Yeah.
Try not to get eaten.
And yeah, Mother Nature is definitely not a Disney movie.
No. So anyway, once they spawn and the snook come in, but the only reason I was kind of bringing that up was we've got so many snook in Cape Coral canals, the Port Punta Gorda canals, Port Charlotte, Lemon Bay, all the way around the canals. Venice is full of snook.
Yeah.
And we're now, May is the spawn month. April's the movement month.
Yeah.
They're going to want to go to where the good salinity is. And if we get rain, a decent amount of rain, they get that fresh water mix in. And that pushes them all the way out to the Gulf. The only reason that's important is because snook can breed in freshwater. Not a problem. The problem comes in with the eggs and the floating of the eggs. When eggs float and then they hatch properly, if there's not enough salt, there isn't enough buoyancy to float the eggs. And they go down to the bottom, lay in the mud, and most of the eggs don't make it.
Right. They just suffocate out.
Right. So they need that salt to keep the eggs buoyant. We've been very lucky with snook populations over the last few years because we had very timely rain. When the rain brings the freshwater river runoff, it pushes those snook out to the barrier islands where the eggs float, and you have a much higher viability or survival rate amongst the eggs.
Yeah, that's true.
And consequently, I think that's why we don't have many redfish. You can have all this seasons, no seasons, and close this and close that, and, oh, people are to blame for this and that and the next thing. Still think it boils down to red tide. When fish hatch and the eggs release into a red tide, they die.
Yeah.
And we're going to see if I'm right. This fall and over the next year and a half or so, we'll find out. If I'm right, we're going to have a lot more redfish. And I was right. If we don't have a lot more redfish, then okay, I was wrong. But we'll find out this next year, year and a half, because we had no red tides during the spawn, redfish spawn this year.
Not much of one.
Now, redfish have actually been doing pretty darn good, but most of them are way up in the harbor. And you've got some out at Widden Creek, Catfish Creek, out and through there and around the Three Sisters and that. But then you got to go looking way in the backcountry. I mean, the Myakka Cutoff's got a bunch of redfish in it. They're up in the Myakka River. We've got them on the west side of the harbor. Excuse me, up in the creeks. I stopped at Wendy's on the way by, and this Diet Coke killing me.
Right. Another area they're catching them at is some of those deeper cuts along the Rim Canal over there in Punta Gorda Isles.
So, again,
some of those deep, deep troughs back in there, they've been catching a handful.
And what I'm hearing is a lot more cut bait is the key to redfish.
Yeah.
I'm hearing a lot about cut bait. little chunks of mullet, ladyfish, threadfin, pinfish. Cut bait has been more the key to the redfish. And I think a lot of the guys throwing live shrimp, live white bait, aren't doing as well on the redfish because for some reason or another, they're looking for a stink bait.
Well, and I mean, there's a lot to be said to that. I mean, a lot of these guys get stuck in their rut of doing the same old every year, and they're spoiled. I mean, to be quite honest, they're just spoiled, you know, for 20 years or whatever that, you know, that I've been doing this. You've been doing it for 30, you know, these
40
yeah. years, yeah. You know, these guys have had the same feeding pattern of all these fish. And now all of a sudden they've changed directions a little bit, so they're not adapting. Not saying that there's a lower population of fish, but they're crying wolf to the extreme where there's other guys that are out there that are doing like you're talking about, using cut bait. Traditionally, cut bait's usually an August thing.
Right. You usually don't switch to cut bait till the water temp hits about 85.
Right.
And for some reason or other, the fish switched. Mm-hmm. And the problem is trying to convince people that what worked really well last year, last month, 10 years ago, may not work that good today. Right. Tomorrow is a whole different ballgame. We don't know what's going to happen. But the more you go out with the more different types of bait, the more likely you are to find a fish. Take a bass fisherman, for instance. He's got five rods laying on the deck. He's got a spinner bait. He's got a worm. He's got a jerk bait. He's got all this different stuff, and he's casting that, picking one rod up, throwing it for a while, working that same area, works with a different rod, works the same area with a different, and he's got them rigged up on different rods, so it's just grab and go, because you don't know which one they're going to be hitting.
Right.
And saltwater fishermen don't have that same
mentality.
Let's try five different things to see if it works. It's kind of like, this is how I fish it.
Yeah. They just stick with what they've always done.
And I think that's the downfall to a lot of the guys who really want to catch the redfish, is this works so well, but now, you know, well, I don't use that. I don't do that. And you're not catching fish, and you're complaining, and you don't want to change.
Right.
Now, wait a minute. Don't. Okay, here. Definition of mental instability is doing this exact same thing over and over again and expecting something different to happen.
Right.
You have to do something different in order for something different to happen.
Absolutely.
Now, let's take snook right now. Sheer numbers, the Storm Twitch Stick is doing really good. But I had a guy in today, he wants to break that. He wants over 40 inches. I said, well, you can't use the same stuff you've been using.
No.
You can't throw the same shrimp or in the same lure. You got to switch into that bigger stuff. Get to the Bomber 16s, the big Rapalas. You got to go up on your bait. Now you got to start thinking, I hate to go back to the freshwater analogy, but you're thinking more musky.
Yeah, I'm going to go with a Savage Trout.
Yeah, you take that big Savage Trout out there and you throw it and you throw it and you throw it. And you're going to make a lot of casts to get that one fish. But if you want the big fish, you're going to have to throw a bigger bait. A Storm Twitch, a big fish can hit, but so will the little ones. But if you're throwing an 8 or 10-inch bait, 6, 8, 10-inch bait, you're going to attract a bigger type of fish. Slow it down. Go low and slow. Deeper and
Absolutely.
Slower. Because I know for a fact that we're sitting here in the studios, and let's say there's this big bang outside, and all of a sudden, ba-boom, all this stuff's happening out there. I'm going to go, hey, Robert, what was that? Now, Robert's a little younger. He might jump out of the chair, go to the door to take a look. But I'm going to kind of get an idea. Well, I wonder what that was. And then I'll think about it. I'll walk over to the door, maybe stick my head out. Finally, I'll make it out of the building. But I'm not going to be, by any means, the first one there.
No, now, I'm not.
40
either.
Years ago, I was, oh, gosh, look at that. Let me go, you know. And I'm not that way anymore. Same thing with the fish. They're bigger. Yeah. They're not going to run and jump to get there. Much more
educated.
And you need to use a lot more scents on your lures. Fish oil, crab oil, the Strike King coffee scent, a good bass smell, WD-40 even.
Yeah.
I mean, get your smell off because you're using that lure slower. Jointed lures are a great one for big snook because you can crank them really slow and get a lot of action out of them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you can get one that'll run fairly deep, bring it along really slow. But the problem with slow movement is Now they see it, they hear it, they come up, they're interested, they get behind it, thinking about biting it, and if all they smell is human on it, they're going to veer off. You're not going to get that. You've got to add a scent to it. Get something on there that smells good to them so that when they come up behind it, okay, yeah, that looked pretty good. Yeah, I like the way it looks. I mean, women, you know this. You go out there, you're in a club, you meet a guy, he looks good from across the way, you hear his voice, yeah, he sounds good. You get up close to him, man, he stinks. You just veer right off. You don't want nothing to do with that one, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Snook is the same thing on a lure.
Yeah. Well, and people don't realize how human scent affects everything. I mean, you've got sunblock, bug spray, in our case, nicotine, and Wendy's.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know. Maybe the Wendy's would actually help. That was a pretty good burger today.
Right.
That's pretty mediocre a lot of times, but today was pretty good.
Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? So people don't realize just all the stuff they touch transmits some kind of scent on there, and they don't look at it from a fish's perspective. Everything we do in life, we humanize everything. So
except when it comes to sight, sound, and smell with a fish.
Right.
Believe it or not, I don't think people give fish they want to give them human emotions and pain sensors and all this other kind of stuff. And then they take away and they think, well, it's a fish, so why wouldn't it just eat that?
Right.
Well, if it doesn't look good, sound good, and smell good, you know, I don't want to eat something that doesn't look and smell good, you know.
Exactly.
And it might not have to sound good. It could just be laying there. But if it doesn't look good and smell good, you know, I'm probably not interested. Fish are the same way.
Yeah.
So use some scent on that. The reason we brought in WD-40 is it's a great cleaning agent. It gets that human smell off. Gets that away from the plug. But I've literally watched a school of skipjacks banging a can of WD-40 in the water. One of those big industrial-sized cans. And it was, I saw something yellow and blue floating in the water. And I could see the fish. And this can is rolling over, rolling over, rolling over. And I get closer, I see the fish hitting it. And every once in a while, they'd go to hit it. And one would hit the spray nozzle. You'd see this little thing up through the water. The little sheen of oil would hit the water. And the fish would go crazy, just bang, 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 bang in that can. And to go off again. And it was amazing to watch. I would not have believed it if I hadn't seen it myself. But so it is a good fish attractant. Lousy lubricant. Great cleaner. Great fish attractant. But I used the Strike King coffee scent on mine. It smells like coffee with cream and sugar, because for years my boat stunk like dead crabs, dead shrimp, dead mullet, you know, pick every obnoxious thing and then add into that mix a little licorice scent, so I got dead bait and licorice smells all over my boat. Now it smells like coffee with cream and sugar. I love Strike King. Thank you for that. I catch fish and my boat smells the way I want it to smell.
That works.
So anyway, let's go into cobia. What's going on with cobia right now?
The Alligator Creek Reef has still been doing pretty darn good on them. But the problem is you're fighting a lot of other boats that have been out there off and on. So that either get out there at first light and plan on spending an hour or so on it, or get there late, late in the afternoon just before sunset and work it. Most of the guys that are doing the best are actually either drifting or very slow trolling with soft plastics, like the DOA Bait Buster has been working good. The Savage Eel has been working good. Spro Bucktail is outstanding with a soft plastic worm on the
All
back
right,
of it as a trailer.
Do the Spro Bucktail, put a gulp bait on it. Something with a curl tail on it, not a paddle tail. A bucktail jig, half ounce, or less. And then match it with a gulp curl tail. Now, the gulp curl tails, and right now the water's pretty clear, so I'm going to go green, pink, green and red, bright colors.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the chartreuse.
Yeah, and I'll go with you on the chartreuse, absolutely. They're kind of in the greens, I guess. But,
yeah.
Those bright colors are really what that's going to get that cobia's attention right now. And the bucktail, take your gulp and put the hook of the jig through the nose of it, going about half an inch, quarter inch, and then bring it back so it extends straight out the back of the jig so it looks like an extension of it. That curl tail is what's going to get that cobia to bite that. The smell of the gulp is going to, when they get close, because cobia really like to smell that food, that's going to make them bite it. So you're covering all your bases. You got the bucktail, you've got the curl tail sound, and you've got that gulp smell, all three of which are going to make that fish bite. Now, I was hoping like the Strike King Crawdad. I had Richie, wild Richie.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know of anything that sounds how do you say that word? I don't know. Raunchous?
I'm not sure where you're going with it.
Richie, I was trying to find something that actually sounded good, but Richie's a cobia guy, and he's absolutely a wild man.
He's just an amazing fisherman.
And he's got it dialed in. But you've got to get all of the elements together. Now, I had Richie. I give him some lures, and I'll say, see about this. The Strike King Crawdad, they follow it right to the boat. They will follow right behind that lure, but you can't get him to hit it. And he's had them following it. They love looking at it. They love listening to it, but they're not eating it. And I don't know why. But, again, that would be a great one to have with you and have it on a very light line. So if you see the cobia out of casting range of your cobia rods, throw that Strike King Rage Claw, the big one, if you can, just past them and just slowly reel it right in front of that cobia and get him to follow it to casting distance.
Yeah.
Getting him to come in, bring that cobia into the casting distance. Any baits you heard of doing well on a cobia, live bait? Everybody's been throwing jigs and gulp or, you know, worms or eels or whatever. Anybody right. doing anything on bait?
Some incidental ones are being caught on shrimp. A couple guys have caught some on some cut ladyfish and some cut sardines. Even a handful have been caught on some white bait out there. But I can't say that there's been one particular live bait that's been working from another.
The best dead bait I've heard of is fresh greenbacks or thread fins cut in half.
Yeah, and I can
actually
see that, absolutely.
Just free line on them or about 4 feet below a bobber, you know, just fresh bait chunk cut up. They seem to like that really well. Haven't heard of much going on for as far as frozen baits for them. It's just one of those weird cobia things where actually artificials are the way to go at this point. Yeah. Now, there was a crab bite went on for just a bit with the cobia. They were hitting the little blue crabs, just banging the heck out of them. And the last couple guys I've sold crabs to didn't do that well with them.
No. They caught a few bonnet heads on them.
Yeah, it was really weird. So, but if you want bonnet sharks, take a little Procure shrimp, the Strike King Rage Claw Crawdad, and a Rockport Rattler jig head. Rig it up just as you would expect to do, starting at the tail, and that little bit of Strike or Procure shrimp scent on that, and bounce the bottom, count one, two, lift, let it fall, count one, two, lift, let it fall, one, two. And the reason I'm saying that is when you lift your rod up, it makes that crawdad jump up in the water, and then as you drop your rod tip, it falls back to the bottom. When it hits, it takes about 2 seconds for that to actually lay over. So lift hard, let your rod tip down, one, two. Take up the slack, lift, let your rod tip down, take up the slack, one, two. And that will catch you bonnet sharks. And you can do it right with the Rage Claw, and they'll just beat the living tar out of it. It's amazing. And actually, kind of funny, you're getting a couple of sharks per soft bait. I mean, it's a very good average. For some reason or other, the bonnets aren't tearing the crawdads off very much.
Well, that's pretty cool. Plus, you're going to get other bycatch like the oddball redfish or the oddball trout because they've been eating it too.
Yeah, you know, it's just kind of fun to be able to throw an artificial for sharks.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of which, one of my favorite things to do is shark fishing because sharks definitely up on the top of the list this week, boys and girls. I like fishing the Atlantic sharp nose. Now, an Atlantic sharp nose looks almost dead on like a black tip. And they will even say the edges of the fins have black on them. In other words, black tips. And the best way to tell the difference between a black tip and a sharp nose is a black tip looks like somebody splashed bleach on it. It's got little white light dots, like it was bleached out, spots of it on there. They grow to be about 4 feet long. Average you're going to catch is about 3 foot. Now, this fish is born, and it's, I think it's about 10, 11 inches long at birth, and that's pretty good for a 3-foot fish.
Yeah.
they can have 1 to 7 pups or young each year, and it takes them about 10 months to do it. So they're really only spawning out, and they're all going to do that right about now. So one of the good things, I'm going to explain to you how to land them, but when I get them up, before I decide if I'm going to eat that fish, I hold the belly and see if I feel the belly squirming. It's really hard to see if a shark is pregnant, unless it, in this one, if it had like 7 pups, you could see it distended. But if it has 1, 2, or 3 in there, you're not going to see the belly distended. You've literally kind of hold the belly and lightly grip it, and if you feel movement in there, okay, put that shark back in the water, because even take it later. Let it have the 3, 1, 3, 5, 7 pups, whatever it's going to be. Now,
the other way is you could just take a male, and sharks are pretty easy to identify between a male and a female.
That's true. Just don't keep any of the females right now.
Yeah.
Now, the males have the two things that stick out of the bottom of them.
Yeah, the claspers on the anal fins back just before the tail. They've got two little fins kind of by their anal opening. And on a male, the fins come to a point, but at the base of those fins, right where it meets the body, there will be a penis-looking thing, for lack of better terms. You know, it's just coming off of back
side. At my age, I'm not sure what that looks like anymore. It's like up in there. I pull on the string every once in a while to figure that out. So you might have to clarify a little bit.
There's just two little elongated fingers coming off the base of that tail on each side of those
good
fins.
Good description, Robert. Very well put.
They're called claspers, which is the male sexual organ.
Gotcha.
And it's very, very distinct. Even on a baby shark, you'll actually see the little nodes there. But on a bigger shark, it's literally going to be on those sharp nose on a 3-footer. Those claspers are going to be about 2 to 3 inches long.
Well, once the Atlantic shark will reach about 30 inches, they can spawn. Believe it or not, from birth to when they reach their full size, they're growing about a third to a half inch a month. And that's a pretty good rate growth.
That's a pretty good rate
growth. So between 1/3 of an inch to 1/2 of an inch a month until they reach full size. And it's kind of weird. The Atlantic sharp nose is one of those that they don't have a tremendously long lifespan. They live about 12 years. And
a little longer than I thought, actually.
I actually thought of sharks as there's some sharks that don't have a lifespan.
Right.
They just live until something kills them. I think hammerheads are in that group.
Yeah, hammerheads, great whites, makos.
Yeah, they literally
larger sharks. Even, I mean, your Greenland sharks, they've got records of Greenland sharks over 100 years old.
No, what is this shark?
Greenland.
Greenland, like the continent?
Yep.
The place? Okay, yep. Greenland. All right. Love shark fishing. There's two usual ways. I mean, you know, you're looking at shark fishing, either anchor up or drifting.
Yeah.
And I'm an anchor up person. I like to anchor for them. Do you do anchoring or drifting?
I honestly like drifting a little bit better, but it just depends on the area or the species I might be looking for.
Now, if I'm up in the harbor, all the way down to, say, Cape Hayes in that general area, I pretty much always put the anchor out. Now, I tie a loop knot in the end of the anchor rope, and I put a crab trap ball on it. Yep. Now, I used to tie a life preserver to it, a bleach jug, put the crab trap ball and something else to identify it. But a lot of people had their anchor stolen.
Yeah.
There's a lot of jerks out there. Yeah. Oh, look at that, you know, and you're off fighting a shark and somebody steals your anchor. So went back to the single crab trap ball, putting a little bit of string from there down to the anchor line. So the anchor line's actually below the water, so it's not visible. And believe it or not, boaters are kind of conditioned when they see a crab trap ball to go around and away from it.
Yeah.
They don't go over to figure out, oh, what's that? If you have a bleach bottle out there, a life jacket, oh, what's that floating in the water? They go over and look, oh, there's an, oh, look at this, tied an anchor line. Oh, I got a free anchor. And line too, and that's expensive. So single crab trap buoy, about a couple of feet of line down to the actual anchor line that I'm tying it to. And with the loop on the end of it, when I do get a big fish, if I need to, I can just throw that overboard and come back and get it.
Right.
Because sometimes you just don't have time to pull the anchor up. Occasionally I do, but most of the time I just throw it overboard. And like I say, nowadays I try and make the buoy look like one of the crab trap buoys in the area. Like some of the guys have blue and white, some of them have red and yellow on their things. And I'll look out and see that, just take a magic marker and kind of make it look like that, rub some dirt on it, make it look a little weathered.
There you go.
You know, a little bit different, but weathered. So, anyway.
You don't want a brand new crab trap buoy sitting out there?
No, because that's like telling somebody my anchor line's here, free anchor.
Or a brand new crab trap.
When I anchor up, first thing I do is I get in an area, I put my anchor out, I got my loop on the cleat, and then I go and I throw out, my first line is a light spinning rod, something I use for redfish or snook, you know, a 6 to 12 pound class, an 8 to 17. I put a bobber on it, about 3.5 feet down, I put a half a sardine or whatever bait I'm using, cast it out there, and I pull about, I put in the rod holder, leave the bail open, pull about another 20, 30 pulls of line out. I want that one away from me. But I step the tip of the rod in the water and watch which way the bobber goes. Because quite often I'm out there and the breeze or the wind is blowing one way, the tide's kind of going, and it's really hard to tell which way the water's actually flowing. And when I'm anchored up, it's because I want to chum over a specific area, a specific place. And what I'm looking for is I look on the chart. I look for the bottom features, the contours. I want to see where the sharks would probably be running. So if you have an average depth of 12 feet, and then you have some cuts on the bottom that are like 14, 16 foot deep, I'm going to try and chum along that cut. Well, if I throw my bobber out and it's going the other way, I'm in the wrong spot. I need to bring the chum back on board. I get my anchor up. I reposition the boat. I don't fall in love with where I anchor. I'm not there to put up a mailbox and receive packages. I don't expect Amazon to, you know, bring my, send me a cappuccino in the, you know, mail there. So, God, I'm so old. You know, God, that's an old person statement. All right. Anyway, so here I am. I'm out there. I anchor up. I get my chum bag in the water. I make sure the chum bag is hanging straight up and down. If it's laying flat on the water, I have to go back and shake it to get the chum out. Now, I'm lazy. I tie it very close to the boat so it's hanging straight up and down about half to three quarters of the way into the water. That way, if I walk to the other side of the boat, it dips the bag. If a boat goes by, we get a little boat wake. Every wave, the boat rocks back and forth, automatically dipping my chum bag. I don't have to do it. I like not having to work. So anchor, chum bag. Next one, the bobber line. I got the bobber line out. It's cool. It's out there, and it's in the right spot, going the right way. So my next line is a free line. Now, when I free line, I'm actually depending on a little bit stronger current. Because if you throw a free line bait out in Charlotte Harbor and there's very little or no current, you might as well put a sinker on it. It's going right to the bottom.
Yeah.
When you've got a bit of a current, the line acts kind of as a parachute. And picture it blowing like a sheet in the wind. It picks one end up, and then the other end lifts up, and finally the back of it lifts up, kind of like in a waving motion, and then it drifts back down, and it'll pick it back up, drift it back down. And the line actually helps lift the bait up off the bottom every once in a while. But in a slow current, that's basically putting a sinker on it. It's not going to have any lift to it. Yeah. So let's say I'm in 14 feet of water. I go for my hook, and I put the hook out, and I go 3, 6, 9, figure 10, 11 feet, and I put a bobber there. Put my bait on, toss it over the side of the boat. Now I'm letting that slow current take that float line that's only about a foot off the bottom, so it gives me that free line kind of appearance to it. It's not dead on the bottom. It's a foot, 2 foot off of the bottom. Remember, I have the other one about 3 feet from the bottom,
right?
Or 3 feet from the top, 3 to 4. So now I'm covering very deep and down there, but it's not hidden in the muck on the bottom. They don't have to dig it off the bottom. It's kind of drifting there. And so I got those two rods in my back two rod holders. Now, if I want to use a sinker line, or preferably I do this with a heavier chunk of bait, the first two are half a sardine, a thread fin, something like that, 4-0 to 6-0 hooks. And I'm using the American Fishing Wire bleeding leader hooks. And the reason I do that is because these hooks are awesome. They're red leader, red hook, black swivel. And what's nice about it is you can bend that barb down. And I can literally roll it. And I roll the point of that barb down. I don't just crush it, leaving a wonderful bump on there. And it doesn't hook in the shark's mouth, but it holds with that little bit of an extra bump there. If you're just get to right to the tip of the barb, kind of squeeze it back a little bit, get your pliers right on the edge of it, and just bend it down. And you'll see it's kind of curved when you're done. It's a great hook for doing that. Some hooks just have to be crushed down. You can't roll them very well. But this one rolls and gives that beautiful bump on there. And these are what I use for my Atlantic sharp nose, my black tips, all these smaller sharks up to about 4 feet. And then I'm using, you know, regular spinning rods with 10-pound mono, 15 mono, 10 to 20-pound braid and line, you know, just 2,500 reel, a 3,000, a 4,000, something like that. And that's what I use to fight the small sharks. But for the bigger lines, I'm going to put a big chunk of bait down. I'm going to put 2, 3, 4 ounces of lead on it, big chunk of mullet about twice the size of my fist or bonita or ladyfish, and I'm going to cast that out at about a 45-degree angle. That big sinker is going to hold it in place and not allow it to roll back and get tangled in my other lines. So now I've got the one just below the surface, 3, 4 feet, the one up off the bottom a couple of feet, and the big bait with a sinker on it.
Yeah, now you're covering all areas of the water column because fish, you know, sharks go by scent.
Right.
And sight, but scent is their primary way of finding food.
Well, to me, that's the reason I want to anchor, because as that chum is going out and the chum gets further away from the boat, it gets faint. The closer you get to the boat, the stronger the chum smell is, because that bag is releasing it constantly. So I like that. Now, why do you drift?
Like I said, I do both, but I'm actually trying to cover a little bit of ground. So there's a couple areas that you know that I really like to fish out there in the harbor because of the contour of the bottom. Like you were talking about finding some of those little drop-offs where they're focal points. And those fish tend to move around a little bit. So I'm usually looking for the larger sharks. And I'm fishing all day for one fish, just like a snook. You know, I'm not fishing for multiple numbers. If I want multiple numbers, I'm fishing for the smaller sharks, which are just a blast on my lighter tackle, and I am going to anchor. But those larger sharks are a bit more solitary versus your smaller sharks.
So how big are you talking about?
Anything over 6 foot. You know, I'm looking for like a bull or a lemon or even a hammerhead or even a very large black tip. You know, and I think that I've found personally covering a little bit of ground in an area where I'm seeing a lot of activity. You know, I'm looking for that contour in the bottom, but I'm also looking for a lot of bait and birds. You know, if all those are around.
Now, are you chumming while you drift?
I will set out. Yeah, absolutely. I'll set out a chum bag just to add to it.
Okay.
But yeah. If it's too fast of a drift, there's no way. I would rather. If I can throw out, if we have a sea anchor on the boat, that's even better. But we'll throw out sometimes a 5-gallon bucket, just do a poor man's sea anchor to slow us way down. But it's got to be a fairly slow drift. If I'm drifting fast, nope, I'm just going to go back to the plain old simple anchor and wait for those fish to come to me.
All right. Now, for me, when I get in those big sharks, the one thing I avoid on my rods is graphite. I like e-glass, fiberglass. I like very strong, heavy tackle that I can put both feet against the side of the boat and pull with both hands. I want to be able to brace myself. I'm a monofilament guy. I like 80-pound or 100-pound test monofilament. I don't like braided when I'm fishing sharks. I like the monofilament, the heavy monofilament. Now, what kind of leader and how long would you make your leader? Is there any kind of judgment for what you're looking on a leader?
Honestly, for me, my setup is completely different than most of the guys. I laugh at people when they say your leader should be as long or longer than the shark that you're fishing for. If they're good at guessing how big that shark is that they're fishing for, how come they haven't won the lottery? You know, I never understood that. They'll tell me.
On the other hand, you could say they're hoping for a 10-foot shark, so they're going to try and use
a 10-foot or 12-foot
leader. 12-foot leader.
Yeah.
Now, one thing, if you're going to do leaders that big, every I would say 4-6 foot, put a swivel in there, a ball bearing swivel. Join the longer lengths of leader, like every 6 foot, I put a swivel there. Go another 6 foot, a swivel, and then whatever you have to this swivel on your line. But if you don't break that up, if you got a 10-foot leader, you need at least one swivel in the middle of that. Otherwise, that shark gets twisting, 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 and you're going to destroy that leader.
Yeah.
So those swivels help really with just about every aspect of it.
Yep. No, it will. But now, for me,
there is a good reason to drift. Because if you're an anchor, you cannot get a 12-foot leader off the boat.
You just jump off the boat and swim it out there and then drop it.
Yeah, I've seen you do that many times.
Not once.
Not once. Not even close.
Not even a dream.
Ankles. No, too deep. Yep. My ankles are wet. I'm going back to shore.
Definitely.
For
me on my rigs, honestly, for like you're using this little short leader for the bonnet heads and Atlantic sharpnose and stuff like that. It's about 18-inch long leader, maybe. 12 to 18 inches long?
No, it says on the package here, 18 inches.
Okay, so it's an 18-inch leader.
There's two in the pack, and it's a, there's 60 pound. I thought they were only 45. Ooh, bigger than I thought.
Believe it or not, for an 8 to 12-foot shark that I'm fishing for nowadays, because I've learned a lot since I was a young lad working with you, my average leader is about 24 inches long. I use personally single strand. I don't care. 10-foot bull shark, no problem.
24-inch leader.
24-inch leader. I'm using single strand piano wire. I think it's like a number 10. I think it's like 120-pound strength. But the biggest difference is I'm using 10 to 30 feet of 150-pound mono leader. Usually I use a wind-on leader, but...
Which rod have we got to order more of?
Which rod?
Out of. We need to order more when we get back to the store. Yeah. We sold out of wind-on leaders.
Yeah.
The wind-on leader is awesome because it can actually get up there. What kind of knot? You got to put a bimini twist on it or something.
Bimini twist or a spider hitch.
So on the main line.
On your main line, because it just creates a loop. All you're doing is creating a loop because that way... The wind-on leader has its own built-in loop, and then you're building a loop out of your line and wrapping the two together, so you're creating basically a little
loop-on-loop.
A loop-on-loop line. It's not even tied. It's just looped over.
When you make the loop on the end of the line, you put the loop that's on the wind-on leader up through it, and then take the other end of the wind-on leader, go through it, and pull it all back the other way so it creates that hitch. But it'll actually come through the guides.
Yeah, you can reel it right through all of your guides, right onto your reel. And two reasons why I do that. The main reason is I like to have a shorter leader to be able to have a leash to grab a hold of. That heavy 150-pound monofilament is good for grabbing a hold of when that fish gets close to the side of the boat to get him under control, to either release him real easily or for, you know, if it happens to be a fish that you are going to keep because it's of legal size and you're going to eat it, I'm okay with that. But
if you kill it, you eat it.
Yeah.
My dad made me eat some of the most awful stuff in the world because I was dumb enough to kill it.
But there's also a lot of protected sharks that we have around here now. And I don't want to mess with a 10 or 12-foot steel leader trying to grab a hold of that while trying to control the fish next to the boat because it just becomes dangerous for me personally. And when I get them up next to the boat...
So you take and wrap the leader around your hand and give it a good pull?
Oh, yeah, absolutely not.
That's a good way to end up in the water with the shark.
Yeah, exactly. It's just dangerous.
And you've just put a hook in his face, so he probably ain't your buddy. He's not your friend. He wouldn't mind a little payback.
If I'm not able to get that flattened out barbed hook out of his mouth safely, I feel very comfortable reaching down... as close as I feel comfortable with to cut off the steel leader, leaving him with as short of a leash as possible.
But now that goes back to why I bend the barbs down on the hook, and I don't use circle hooks.
And I don't either, but I still flatten the barbs too, but there are times where you got too big of a shark, it's just dangerous. So to me, whether I'm using a dollar hook or a $15 hook.
But if you bend the barb down and you cut the leader... The hook will probably just fall out.
Right.
It doesn't have to rot out. It can literally just
work its way out.
Yeah. It's actually less
less harmful
than a stingray barb. And I can tell you, it's a couple of big sharks. I've used a very long pair of pliers and actually pulled stingray barbs out of the roof of a shark's mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Looking at it going, man, that's got to be a little uncomfortable. And I just jerk them out of there. But that hook with the barb bent down will literally fall back out. So if you cut the leader with a circle hook, it's got to literally let the acids in the shark's blood, which do more damage to the you had me worried there for a minute. I didn't know what
I was doing a circle hook.
Oh, okay. I didn't recognize the hand signals. The producer was giving me hand signals. I thought he was making the form of a circle hook. Circle hooks do a great job of hooking the fish, but they were never meant to come out.
No.
They were not a catch and release hook. It's an awful, awful catch and release hook. If you're going to do circle hooks on sharks, bring a bolt cutters with you.
Yeah.
Because it's the only way you're getting that circle hook out is to literally cut it with a pair of bolt cutters. And if you left the barb on it and didn't crush the barb down on that circle hook, that fish, the acids in the blood is what's going to erode that. Very little of this happens with the salt water. It usually has to be the fish's biology that corrodes it, and that's not exactly healthy. I mean,
and it's a long-term proposition.
Long process.
I mean, think about what it takes for the average person that gets a splinter in their finger. Several days, 10 days later, it starts to fester up a little bit. Your body's trying to fight it to get that out. Shark's doing at least that.
Exactly. So, you know, the best thing, now, the thing about using the J hooks the way we do is we set the hook on the fish when it starts moving. We don't let them swallow it.
No.
You don't sit there and wait for him to eat it, digest it, and half excrement it, you know?
Well, and I've gone out and done some tagging with some of the marine biologists, and we did a study with the circle hooks versus J hooks. And the craziest part is the J hooks versus the circle hooks, for the majority of the fish that we were catching, the free line baits that were drifting naturally in the current or anything under a bobber, 98% of them hooked them the exact same way. It was the ones that were on the bottom that were sitting in an anchored position is where the circle hook was hooking them more in the corner of the mouth than the J hook was. They seemed to have a better opportunity to swallow it that way. So that was one of the points that they were actually kind of made us learn a little bit that never paid attention to it. That bait just drifting in the water column, those fish actually come by and grab it and keep going, versus if it's on the bottom, they sometimes have to mouth it to get around to it to grab it just right, and they end up inhaling it before they start to swim away.
Yeah, they're more apt to just swallow it down.
Yeah.
Because I think when they're swimming through it, they're actually trying to capture it, get a hold of it, and more so than gulp, gulp, gulp off the bottom, actually just trying to chomp it and swallow it in the same motion. Man. Okay. For what are we going today? That's the floating, rattling bobber, the night bobby. Like night fishing for sharks, have a lot of lights in the boat, though. I want to grab one other bit of information. The tarpon have come in real heavy here in the last few days. What's going on with tarpon, Robert?
In Boca Grande Pass, they're catching some good numbers of tarpon, pretty much from early morning into the evening. The sharks have moved in there on them, and lucky for them. But the guys that are really doing the most success are catching them on big shrimp and squirrel fish. That's been the primary target or food target for those tarpon out there in the passes. But if you don't want to mess with the pass, you can go out on the beaches. I suggest heading south of Boca Grande towards Sanibel, or if you're coming from the harbor heading out that way, definitely look in the 20-foot holes, because there has been some resident fish showing up in there fairly regularly.
There's some big fish in the deep holes in the harbor right now. You can drift cut bait, put a DOA bait buster under a bobber, literally about 4 feet.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be the big bobbers, just the oval floats. And tie the DOA bait buster to it, especially if you've got a light chop on the water. It's called bobber jigging. As the bobber goes up and down, it jigs the bait up and down. So you want a couple inches to a foot of chop on there. And just set it in the rod holder, back the drag down a bit. You don't want a tight drag on that because it's in the rod holder. So yeah. you want to be able to get it out of the rod holder, then adjust your drag. Be able to pull some line out. Not easy, but not super hard. And that's a great way to hook tarpon up in that deep hole. And then you can be casting a lure, doing whatever. Chunks of bait fish. Let's see. I don't think they're doing much on ladyfish. It's about shrimp right now is the big thing.
Shrimp.
And nobody believes you when you say you gotta be throwing shrimp right now.
And even if they do believe you, they think they've got to have something that's the size of your hand to catch them on. I mean, literally, if it's the size of the average person's index finger, so if it's, let's say, 3 inches long, that's going to be perfectly sufficient for them because that's what the primary food source is around here right now. So, yes, a hand pick and a jumbo is nice because you're casting it at times to some of those fish that you're seeing.
All right, now, how are you hooking that shrimp? I'm going across the head usually.
I'm going to go right across the head, absolutely.
I've got to have a bigger hook. I've got to have at least a 5-aught hook to be able to get the hook into the tarpon. And if I try going up through most of those ways, it'll break the shrimp up. But if I go just under the horn, that big 5-aught hook isn't quite so bad.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you could go through the mouth and out the top of the head or just sideways across the horn.
You can go from the bottom, but you got to be real careful to make sure it's centered. If it gets slightly cockeyed, it splits the shell.
Yeah, because it's tough getting that big a hook in a smaller shrimp. But it is doable.
Absolutely.
And one of the things you can do, and that's becoming very, very popular, is to get the Fish Bites, and that's a brand of fish attractant, Fish Bites. And it comes in little strips. So let's say your shrimp are a little smaller than what you're looking for. Say they're 3.5 fingers, not 4 or 4.5 fingers. It doesn't seem like a difference between 3 fingers and 4 fingers, but if it's 4 fingers, as shrimp get longer, they also get thicker. It makes a much bigger presence. And that's kind of 4 fingers is about what you want if you can get it. 4 fingers, if you laid it across 4 of your fingers, that would be the size. And then what I want to do is put the Fish Bites on first. But I'm hooking it a little funny because I want it to trail back. And then I put the live shrimp on it, and I'll make the strip 4, 4.5 inches, cut off a 4, 4.5 inch strip off the roll of Fish Bites. It comes in a long roll, kind of like a half inch wide strip of bubblegum is what it looks like. And I'll cut that at about 4.5, 5 inches. Then I put the live shrimp on there, that 3, 3.5 inch shrimp. And with the shrimp flavored Fish Bites and the live shrimp on there, that's going to give you that little bigger presence, the same smell. It's going to work. I think that's going to be the secret to getting some of those bigger tarpon to hit the smaller shrimp and make it overall look better.
Yeah. No, I'd like to try that. That worked. That's
kind of like the shrimp sitting on a sled.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I like that idea a lot. You know, the other one that's been working well, too, that a lot of guys have been buying has been the jumbo DOA shrimp. That jumbo DOA shrimp has been being used quite a bit, so guys are using those out there in the 20-foot holes or out there on the beaches and drifting them. But I've had a couple guys actually experimenting with live bait. You know, they're setting up their live bait rigs out there in the past with those giant DOA shrimp and working very, very well.
All right. How much time we got left there, boss?
A minute and a half.
You got a minute and a half. Okay. Well, you lucky devils. See, just when you thought you might be getting rid of us, no, you're stuck here again for another minute and a half. Tarpon up in the harbor. We've got some up the Peace River, up by Harbor Heights North, up by the Sansucci Trestle up there. We're seeing some up around Northport, the 41 Bridge, working the way down south to Elgebine. You can find them down at Elgebine. There's some down in Ponarasa off Knapp's Point on Sanibel. Coming back up the Intercoastal, they're going to work north slower. The vast majority of the tarpon fishing right now, even though there is some in the Englewood, Stump Pass area, but they haven't got the big population yet.
Yeah, most of those Sanibel are solitary resident fish working its way up north. Yep.
Because most of these tarpon are coming from the south. If you're out there grouper fishing right now, and let's say your compass failed and your GPS blew up and you have no idea how to get home, watch and you'll see a school of tarpon just going across the surface. We call it dolphin, porpoising, And you can just go in behind them, stay back, just keep them in sight, and they will take you right to Boca Grande Pass.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're coming from Louisiana, they're coming from Texas,
Mexico,
Belize, Mexico, all over the place. They come from all over. We even have some of these tarpon come from Africa, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, absolutely. They travel that far.
So it's literally just an amazing experience to be out in Charlotte Harbor right now. Big schools of black drum, big schools of Jack Crevel. Watch for mudding in the water. When you see that dark stain in the water, check it out because that is a school of big fish. If the water's all clear and you see a big brown stain, nope, not me in an old person's accident. That was actually a big school of fish.
Yeah.
Fish and Frank here in the chair, Robert in the chair across from me. And this has been Fish and Frank's. We're not sure if the show has a name or if it doesn't have a name, but we're going to work on that. And how are we just about there, sir?
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll see you guys on the next Radio Fishing with Fish and Frank and Robert. Bye, boys and girls.